Man, we're sitting here in your garage, and you mentioned last time I think I was here that you were going to empty some boxes out, but it looks like you have a lot more boxes than when I was here last time.
There are a few more typewriters that have appeared.
Man, and as I sit here, you've got a bottle of Zymol cleaner wax, and then you've got three alligator skin royal peas. You're four of them. He's got one hidden under his brand new Etc. magazine, and which you did the artwork for.
Yeah, I was lucky to be asked to do an article in there, and then Peter Wheel mentioned to Paul that I had done a watercolor of a royal pea, and so Paul was like, there's our cover.
Man, so you've got a lot going on. We've got a lot going on. I'm glad that we're doing these podcasts again, and we've got an exciting guest here today. We've got Professor Mark Schrod. He is from Villanova University. He hails out of Pennsylvania, and he is going to be talking to us today about a wide range of things that he is interested in with his typewriters.
Yep, he has some of the most fascinating stories and histories of typewriters that I've seen. He collects typewriters like a lot of us, but these typewriters are have interesting stories.
Well, the other good thing is, compared to the previous call-ins that we've had in the past, I've actually learned how to use my Zoom H6 so that we can do phone calls now for our guests, and they're going to sound like they're right next to us as opposed to some wonky phone call. So let's go ahead and get this podcast started as we call him on the line and do our little intro. You're listening to Austin Typewriter Inc. Podcast. Welcome to the Austin Typewriter Inc. Podcast. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to listen to our little gab fest. We're just a group of folks who enjoy the heck out of typewriters and welcome you to our table. Sit back and enjoy the show, and away we go. Hey guys, Austin Typewriter Inc. in the house. We are here at Garaje Everito, and Everito is in the house. How you doing, Everito?
Super. We are sitting in the garage surrounded by bicycles and typewriters.
Yeah, we've got a wide range of, I see typewriters all over the area around me, but I see boxes. I'm waiting for sirens to quiet down and lights went out, so we've got a really wide range, but I'm super, super, super excited because we've got a special guest in today, which is going to be, a lot of you are also going to be special guests in the future that come onto the podcast. But I met this gentleman, Everett did too, over in Herman's in October 2019. Mm-hmm. So I want to welcome to our podcast Mr. Mark Schrod. Mm-hmm. And is it Dr. Mark Schrod?
Just call me Mark.
Okay, well, amongst
we could go that way. I don't want to go that
amongst
way.
Amongst the Typesphereans, we'll call you Mark. And how are you? How's it going? Where are you hailing from?
We're out in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, which is on the main line suburbs of Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, it's worth $50.
$50. That's become one of my favorite memes.
Yep. At first, I thought it was kind of sassy at first, but then I started looking at it. It was like, hey, you know, that actually is pretty good, because I didn't catch it that it was Bo Diddley at first.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you. My first question out of the gate is typically, how did you get started with typewriters in your life?
Ooh, you know, I'm sure there's like the short game and the long game. I remember when I was, you know, when I was a kid doing homework on my mom's, I think it was a 64 Galaxy, you know, Smith Corona Galaxy. You know, I have very fond memories of that. And then, you know, getting into high school, you started getting into the word processors that you would, you know, you type up a little bit on a little tiny, you know, LED screen, and then it would all just churn out all at once, which was fine. And then, of course, you got into like the computer age. And so, you know, the typewriters kind of disappeared for quite some time. And then in terms of collecting, I think, you know, what got me into it was, you know, I was a new professor here at Villanova, and I was kind of redoing my office, and I wanted to get rid of a lot of the metal in the office, you know, so metal, you know, bookcases, metal filing cabinets. And I think somewhere along the line, I picked up a wooden filing cabinet, and, you know, from the 1920s. It was rotten, you know, it was pretty messed up. And so I took it apart. I you know, stripped it down or refinished it, and I put it in my office, and it looked incredible, you know. And so I was like, well, this is kind of cool. So I started with that. I redid a couple of, you know, for a while it was just furniture. It was, you know, wooden filing cabinets and desks and stuff. And then, you know, just trying to get into the time frame of it, I started, you know, wanting to get a typewriter. And so I think in one of these, you know, I'm originally from the Midwest. I'm from Iowa. My whole family's in Iowa. And so we would do these transcontinental drives. And I think it was at one of those big antique malls in Ohio, I think like Springfield, Ohio. I stumbled across a Remington 5, you know, one of the streamliner ones, one of the super shiny 1930s, 40s, whatever. And it was like, you know, $40. And so I picked it up, you know, did the thing. I was like, oh, this must be broken because there's no number one key. So maybe I can negotiate. Obviously, there are no number
right.
one keys.
And what year are we talking about right now in terms of that trip?
Circa. That was probably 2013, I want to say, somewhere around there. So, you know, I don't know, 8 years ago now we're mm-hmm. looking. And so, you know, I started looking around for stuff, you know, associated with it. And you've probably seen these online, but I came across, you know, I think it's defunct now, but they had a USB typewriter. It pops up on the forums every once in a while.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, and so I was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. So I bought one of those kits, you know, to transform this Remington Streamliner into a USB typewriter. And it worked. It didn't work well, but it worked. You know, I could plug it into my computer and type away on it very slowly. And for kicks, I decided to rim the entire inside of the machine with blue LED lights to get kind of like that backlit effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this USB typewriter that was glowing blue, you know, and I started sharing with some of my friends, and they're like just blown away. They're like, what is this? How, you know, what kind of sorcery is this?
What is this? Right.
And so I was like, hey, I got this old timey computer, you know, it's a typewriter. I can plug in my computer. It seems to work pretty well. And then I started, you know, spending more time using it and finding out, you know, that it was sort of the tactile experience was really pleasurable. And, you know, the next thing started poking around on, you know, the Craigslist ads and all this and finding ones that were, you know, new and unique and weird looking. And that, you know, that's sort of the weird looking, you know, typewriters, I think, are what really brought me in.
Did you find it a little amazing in your area alone how many typewriters were just sitting around?
Yeah. You know, I think I have the virtue of, you know, geography here, you know, in up and down the East Coast, you know, within an hour's drive. There's so many typewriters, you know, and so it's not like you're just kind of, you know, waiting for one thing in particular. Just stuff pops up all the time. And, you know, I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm looking at, I got a last night just out of the blue, literally 5 minutes away from me, popped up a 1931 Burgundy Smith Corona flat top with the thing on. And they're just getting rid of it, right? And so I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah.
So oh, wow. I'm sitting here kind of polishing it up. And there's just so much stuff out here, you know, and as compared to, like I said, my family's all in the Midwest. They're in Iowa. I check the listings in, you know, Des Moines and in Minneapolis and something. And there's just not a whole lot out there, right? So, but here it's everywhere you turn, so.
That's kind of typical of Texas, too. Like here in Austin, we don't really find that many typewriters. And when you do, they're typically the standard typewriters.
Oh, yeah. Galaxies. And you'll find lots of Royals and Galaxies and Smith Coronas. Typically, you don't see anything exotic.
So from your love of the original typewriter that you bought and from that, which you said is about 2008, where did you start to decide that you were going to pursue being a collector, and how did you merge yourself into the typewriter community?
Well, as I say, it's like going broke, right? It happens very gradually, and then all of a sudden, you know. So the same sort of thing is, it just kind of, you know, one became two, and then two became three, and then, you know, I was starting to get, you know, some curious looks from my wife about how many of these do you need, you know, really?
Yes, I know that one.
Right. And so I'm just like, I don't know. I don't need is a, such a flexible
exactly
concept,
right?
So, no, so it just kind of, it kind of grew and grew. And I think maybe by 2016, you know, I was, you know, going actively after, you know, certain models and trying to hunt them down and, you know, driving longer and longer distances to find particular machines that I thought were fun and interesting and unusual and weird.
In terms of the word weird, what do you find to be a typewriter that you would define as weird or at least unique to your interests?
Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, the ones that are funky looking, right? So, I mean, Oliver's, you know, the Batwing designs. I think one of the first ones I got was here locally. It was a Remington 17 with like a 26-inch Platen. And so just this idea that, you know, you have this monster, you know, that now I can never get rid of. But
right.
It was just such a, like, what the heck is this thing? And why, you know, you start going into why, you know, how did it evolve and why did they use it and what was it used for? And you know, so those sorts of things, you know, upstroke typewriters and, you know, and just looking around here, you know, on my workbench, you know, most of the stuff that I have is, you know, pre-World War II, and most of it is actually pre-World War I. Just things that are unusual, that kind of show that, you know, the early ingenuity and the ideas that went into designing typewriters and trying to figure out a, you know, making a better mousetrap, you know, from the Index ones to, you know, to the Upstrike models, to the, you know, to the Olivers and to eventually the, you know, sort of the Front Strikes. But yeah, it's just, you know, kind of an interest in the history and the evolution of these types of machines.
Well, you're a history buff. Is that, am I understanding that correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, tell me, based on your, I love when I like to read the conversations. I never jump into them because I just don't have the knowledge that you all have. But I love to type, I love to get into the conversations that you all have on the antique collectors group.
Right.
Because there are, y'all have these really in-depth historical conversations that are, that really need to be put in book form. Maybe they are, and y'all just, you know, pulling excerpts from memory. But in your studying of the history that you're talking about right now, how did you see the evolution of typewriters really develop in business and commerce into the U.S. economy, for example? How did that really change how we lived then?
That I'm not as well versed in, sort of the American side. I mean, I do political science and I do history as kind of my profession, you know, and I write a lot of books. I got another one coming out that's in the spring that does have some typewriters involved, which is good. You know, most of my area of focus is on Europe and Russia. And so,
well, talk about that then.
Sure.
Loop that into your, I was trying to, I don't know your history as much as you would. Bring that around and talk about that. Ever, go ahead.
Yeah, Mark was posted a really amazing Underwood 5 that is in itself, that's that typewriter is a book, right? it has a embedded history that is fascinating. If you could elaborate on that would be amazing.
Absolutely. It's right here actually behind me. I have it for, you know, when I'm teaching my classes and Zoom, you know, my Zoom meetings are on my typewriter workbench, and so I've got this one sitting right over my shoulder, so when I'm teaching my students and all that. No, but the one that you mentioned is a 1914 Underwood 5 that was sold to the Gerlach company. And Gerlach was an interesting figure in Europe. He was I guess he was born in the Prussian Empire, I guess in Prussia, in the German Empire, in Berlin in, you know, the 1830s, 1840s, and migrated into, I guess, what is now Poland. But that part of time was part of, you know, is the Polish part of the Russian Empire. And so he moves to Warsaw, and this Gerlach guy becomes sort of this, he's an expert in high grade mechanics and optics. And so optics for surveying equipment and, you know, I guess chemistry and measurement and all sorts of, you know, really specific high tolerance mechanics, right? And so he gets quite a name for himself that he's becomes by the 1880s he becomes the chief purveyor to the Tsarist court in St. Petersburg, He becomes the chief purveyor of like all these high grade, you know, mechanical devices and optics. And so eventually he apparently gets into making, he becomes the exclusive purveyor of Underwood models to the entire Russian Empire. You can find these, you know, there are not a whole lot of them left. And I was super excited to find it just because I think the history of it is so fascinating. Tomasz Zak in Poland had one of these Gerlachs. And so there, it's just an Underwood 5, but, you know, all of the decals, all the plates are in Russian. They're all in Cyrillic, and they say, you know, Gerlach typewriter. They say, you know, they have their locations in Warsaw and in Moscow and in Nevsky Prospekt in St. Petersburg, which is a half block from the Winter Palace. And so this is really fascinating. It's like, I've always wanted one of these. It's, you know, it's got the Russian tie-in. But most of the Gerlachs that you can find, and, you know, just a Google image search, you can find, you know, some of these that are out there, maybe a, you know, a dozen or two that I've been able to, you know, find online. But what makes the one that I got rather unique was that it is not a Russian key set. It's not even, you know, it's not old Russian. It's not even Polish. For whatever reason, it's in Swedish.
Hmm.
It's got a QWERTY keyboard with, you know, the Swedish oohs and ahs and the other accented marks to it. And that was the thing that just sold me on it and just made my jaw drop, because in terms of my own research, my interest was in comparative politics and in history. And in particular, one of the things I'm really interested in is alcohol politics. And so the history of alcohol in Russia and the United States and that's kind of been my focus. So when my dissertation, you know, when I was doing the research for that, I wanted to write sort of a drunk history of Russia. And so that was my focus. I want to go to Russia and write this drunken history. I spent a lot of time in Russia. It should be, you know, should be interesting, should be fun. But they said to me, okay, well, you have to do, it's comparative politics. You have to compare with other countries or other case studies. And I'm like, well, okay. So I'll compare Russia, which I know fairly well. The other case, hey, we had prohibition here in the United States. I can compare that with the United States. And then I was going to go to Germany, because I already spoke German. I know German, lived in Germany for a while. And I was like, oh, but there was actually, you know, if you go back 100 years, there really wasn't much interesting in the world of alcohol politics that was going on in Germany. Where the really interesting things were going on 100 years ago was Sweden, in terms of alcohol restrictions, alcohol politics. And so I taught myself Swedish, took a whole year just to do that, and then went to Sweden to do archival work there. And that eventually became my dissertation, my first book. And so the point being, you know, for the tie into the typewriter, you know, my interests were the United States, Russia, and Sweden. And now I've got this typewriter that was built in Hartford, Connecticut at the Underwood facility, exported to the Russian Empire. So it has, you know, old Russian on it. And then it types in Swedish, right? So I was like, how perfect is this? You know, maybe it's not a perfect machine for any collector who's out there, but it was like the perfect machine for me because it perfectly dovetailed with all the things that I found particularly interesting about that point in time.
And it's very unique when you look at it because the Cyrillic characters on the front of it, it's easily recognizable as an early American standard from the early teens. But then you start looking at it and you're like, wait a minute, those decals are just amazing, and how the graphics wrap around the scallop cutout. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, that's why I saw it. My jaw dropped. And it sat there for a while. You know, it's only the second one that I've purchased from Tomas, you know, and he's just wonderful. But, you know, I bought a Stower Standard from him earlier last year, and I was very, very pleased with that. So I knew, you know, what I was getting myself into. But also it was, you know, I'm not like one of these high-end collectors, right? I've got a very small budget. You know, I kind of dabble in the, you know, the $20 to $40 range. And so, like, these high-end ones are just largely out of my range. So in order to kind of justify that in terms of, you know, family finances and so on, I ended up, you know, this fall kind of offloading a pretty sizable chunk of the collection that I had, you know, through the classified section, through, you know, all these things, just to make, you know, kind of room not only in the collection but also in the budget, you know, to be able to afford some, you know, importing something from Poland that was found in Norway, that's in Russian, and in Swedish. So that was kind of the the story behind that whole thing. And it's one of my, you know, the things that I stare at it, you know, it gives me quite a bit of, you know, pleasure just to look at it, just to have it there, you know, and have it on the desktop.
So basically this machine was, you said it was built in Connecticut, traveled across the Atlantic, spent some of its years overseas, and now it's made its way back here.
Yeah.
That's full pretty circle. That's a really, I mean, just the history of the machine's travel is pretty unique. And that, and then the more, to me, the more unique part is that it landed, you know, with you and that interest that you just talked about. That in itself is pretty unique.
It's a perfect storm of timing and events, right?
Yeah. And having that sort of connection, you know, makes it really special. You know, those are the things that, you know, I'll go out, sure, you know, that there are, you know, there are typewriters around the Philadelphia area and, you know, Eastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey that I can go out and get, but I can't get something like that.
No,
you know? So there's the ones that kind of in the collection that kind of come and go, and then there are the ones that are going to be with me forever. And I think that's one of the ones that's going to be with me forever for obvious reasons.
Oh, definitely. Everett and I were talking about this just maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, because he's trying to hone in on the Royal P, and then there's like maybe one unique typewriter that he really wants, but it's a little bit higher. But he's been actually offloading, and I've noticed over the last month or two, I was like, man, you've been really selling a lot of your typewriters. And
yeah, that's basically exactly what you said, Mark. You know, it's like, okay, you want that whatever X dollar, 600, you know, whatever dollar, you know, oh, that's insane amount of money, right? But so I'm like, okay, I can get rid of 6 of these for $100 a piece, so I can reason, you know, swapping out or whatever the price is. But I totally understand that. It's like, and also they take up space. I mean, you know, I think I was up over 100 at one time. I think I'm down to, I don't know, 75 or 60. I don't know. It kind of flexes, right? So what's your collection look like now? How many,
Oh, I don't know. I started this fall sort of uploading information to the database.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it's useful to have that as kind of a, you know, a benchmark. I think altogether I'd right around 125, but that's including ones that have come and gone.
Yeah.
You know, some that I've sold, some that I've... One of the ones that I like to do was to have them in my office, you know, on campus back, you know, pre-COVID. And then, you know, students would come into the office and they'd see all these typewriters and just be kind of blown away. Like, what is this stuff, right? One of the things I always like to have is, like, find some $5 typewriters, some $10 typewriters that, you know, you can find at a garage sale or something like that. Fix them up and just have them on hand. So, like, a student comes in and says, hey, you know, that's a really cool typewriter. I wish I had one, you know, and I'll just go, here, take this one, you know. And then you've just kind of, I don't want to say you've infected somebody with that sort of interest, but, you know, you've encouraged somebody to explore and to utilize it. And so it's, you know, that's one of the things I like to do with these machines. So I've got a bunch at the office. I've probably got maybe 15 at the office now. I've probably got, you know, another 20 here in my workbench that need to be worked on. So I don't know, maybe I'm south of 50, which is, I guess, better than it used to be.
I totally understand that.
Yep.
So do the students that you interact with, did they come and ask you, what type of questions do they ask you in regards to the typewriter and the technology that they understand today being, you know, their cell phone?
It's weird because I would use them a lot, you know, so obviously pre-COVID and everything going online, but I would make sure that students, if they wrote a term paper or any sort of assignment, they hand it to me on paper, right, as opposed to doing it electronically. And if they email it to me electronically, I print it out and do it. So what I would do is I would grade these, oftentimes, you know, outside in the sunshine on campus. You know, I'd just grab a typewriter and go out. I'd read through, you know, what they wrote, and then I would write up my comments at the end instead of it, you know, doing the hand cramp thing, trying to scrawl illegibly on students' papers. You know, I would type it. You know, I would type all the conclusions. And so that's kind of how I would use it. And then every once in a while, I would have a student come into the office, and then, you know, all of a sudden you see, you know, their eyes kind of light up, and they look around, and they see, you know, I've got a Remington 2 from, you know, 1882, and then I've got a Calligraph, and I've got a Hammond in there, you know, all these, you know, again, very unusual to the eye machines. And then all of a sudden, you know, you recognize that you're having this talk with a student in your office, and they are not looking at you. They're looking at everything else that's in this room. with all these machines. And they would ask those questions, you know, do you use these? And then I had one student in particular who said, who came in and just, you can see things click in his mind, right? And he looks up and he goes, oh, so that's how you got all those little markings onto our papers.
I was like, marking?
What? You know, in my mind, I didn't say this, right? I was like, what do you mean marking? This, it's a typewriter. Have you never seen a typewriter? Do you not know?
Right.
You know, what this is? Like, it's not some sort of magic that was imprinted, you know, or maybe it was. Maybe that's what this whole thing is about in the first place. So
that's funny. The typewriters are kind of the wedge point. You can't walk up to them and go, nah, whatever, you know. Well, I guess you can, but for students that are, you know, being educated, they see this and they understand what they were used for after a while, right?
Well, it's kind of like type-ins too. When you see people that have never seen them, especially you deal with college students, but we see the younger kids and they look at it like they almost like a cat. They crawl up real close to it and sniff it, and I'm like, it's right. A machine, man. It works just like your cell phone, except you have to actually use some actual muscle to push the button. You have to,
right.
Yep.
So have any of your students turned in papers on a typewriter?
No, they haven't. The closest I've gotten is I've had some students, if I'm outside grading, you know, on the quad or something, I would have students come up to me, like students that aren't even my students, who already are into the typewriters, right? You know, that maybe have one or two that they use, and they just want to talk shop, right? Oh, yeah. And so I will put down everything to talk shop with somebody, you know, especially, you know, somebody who's 18, 21 years old and you know, kind of just getting started into this stuff, you know, just letting them know that they have a friend, you know, that can understand these sorts of things. And if I even offer to, you know, if they say, well, it was working for a while and then something's not working anymore, I'm like, just bring it by my office. We'll fix it. You know,
exactly.
I don't even know who you are. I don't care who you are. I will fix your typewriter for you. Right. You know,
I love it.
But just to have that, that interaction is great.
Talk a little bit about your books, because you told me that you had several books out and you've got one coming that you were working on. Talk a little bit about some of the book titles that you've written, what they're about, where people can find them.
Sure. I mean, they're all on, you know, Amazon, if need be. The first book was based on my dissertation. It's called The Political Power of Bad Ideas. And, you know, it was based on a comparative analysis of alcohol politics in the United States and Russia and Sweden, as we talked about. But it's not just about, you know, about that. It's about, you know, how these ideas in terms of policies get filtered through different political institutions to result in different policies like alcohol prohibition. Right. And so they had alcohol prohibition in Russia. We had it here in the United States. They did not have it in Sweden, which had less to do with sort of temperance sentiment and more to do with how the ideas kind of filter through political institutions. And they studied this question for 12 years and ultimately decided against it. So there's something about, you know, the interplay of ideas and institutions is kind of what it was about. But it was also about alcohol politics. And so that was my dissertation. That was the first book. It's not very good. Looking back on it, I would not recommend anybody going out
<You're funny. laughs>
to buying it. But what happened, and this is kind of the backstory, is that I graduated and I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin in 2007, which is right when the global economy imploded, I'm sure as you remember. And just like any other, you know, occupation, just nobody was hiring at that point. Like all the jobs disappeared. And so, you know, I worked for many, many years to try to get, you know, a permanent, you know, teaching gig, and there's just nothing out there. And so the only thing that I could find was the University of Illinois down in Champaign-Urbana hired me on to do for a 1-year contract to teach like a bajillion courses with, you know, even more students. Right? Actually, it was only 3 courses per semester. But, you know, these were classes with 500 students, you know, 250 students at a time. It was ridiculous. Wow. Right. So 1 year, you know, became 2 years became 3. Every year I'm going out, it's kind of a yearly hiring cycle, just striking out left and right, just because there are no jobs, right? And so at that point in time, I've got a book to my name. I've published, you know, a published author. I cannot find a job anywhere just because there's nobody interested in, you know, hiring during the financial crisis, but also, you know, nobody was really interested in Russia, Russian politics. And so my wife and I got together. At that point in time, we had, you know, 3 kids. And you know, I was working this job nonstop, and it just didn't look good. I mean, I was making, with summer teaching, I was making, you know, for a family of five, I was making $48,000 a year, which doesn't really go very far
Right.
for a family of five, right? And so we made this decision. We said, okay, if nothing opens up in the fourth year on the job market, you know, we're just going to pack it up. We're going to take this dream. We're going to pack it up. We're going to move to Washington, D.C., and do whatever it is you do with a PhD in political science in Washington, D.C. Thank God I don't know what that is. Because that's where things finally started opening up. I started getting, you know, job offers all these different places, and that's where I ended up at Villanova. But as this whole thing was unfolding at Illinois, I was like, man, I would hate to leave this occupation. I would hate to leave this career without writing the thing that I had had in the back of my mind for 20 years, which was this drunken history of Russia. You know, I took and developed a couple sample chapters. I wrote up some sample chapters of kind of what I had in mind. I wrote up a book prospectus, kind of the idea of, you know, what I was going to do and what it would look like. And then I went to Chicago. I drove up to Chicago from Champaign to this big political science convention. They also have a book room where they have book representatives, and you can kind of shop, you know, the idea around. And I didn't even have enough money to get into the conference. I didn't even register for the conference. I just actually had a friend, and I borrowed his credentials, his lanyard,
Oh
you know,
man.
with all the
Hey,
stuff.
whatever works.
Yeah. Snuck in through the back door, essentially, and just kind of shopped this idea for this drunken Russian history around. And it just killed. Everybody wanted this thing.
Wow.
And so that ultimately became the second book, which is Vodka Politics, Alcohol Autocracy, and the Secret History of the Russian State. And that thing went gangbusters. It got translated into a half dozen world languages. You know, there are audiobook versions of it, all this stuff. And so, you know, it's an interesting book. You know, it's better, certainly better than the first one. But it also taught me like just how fleeting everything is, right? That for the longest time, I've got two books in hand, and I can't get a permanent job, right? You know, I'm
Poor guy.
unemployable. Yeah, and so it's like one success in one area has nothing to do with success in any other areas. So those are the two, and now I've got this third one coming out, and I guess the first two had absolutely nothing to do with typewriters. The third one does a little bit. I try to sneak it in as best I can in all these different places, and so. Just kind of backtracking, when this vodka book came out, I went to Russia to present it, right? And so I gave this keynote address to this conference in Moscow. I gave it an hour and a half long speech, all in Russian, which was I'm astounded that I was still able to pull that off, you know, after so many years of not speaking Russian. But I was expecting that the people in the audience, and they were all Russians, were going to be very upset with what I had found, because the findings of the book are not particularly flattering to Russia. It takes this idea that, you know, that why do Russians drink vodka? It's not something that's in their DNA. It's not some genetic predisposition, but it's because, you know, distilled spirits like vodka are extremely profitable to the state. And, you know, the czarist state made one-third of their entire revenues off selling vodka to their own people. And then even the Soviet Union made, you know, a quarter of all the revenues of the mighty Soviet Empire, even in the 1980s, was based on selling vodka to their own people, right? And so I was like, this is pretty scathing stuff if you're going to go to Russia and tell Russians that this is what's
Right.
going on. And but they were super cool, super chill, and you know, all these professional historians were like, yeah, we know that.
Why
Why
didn't you
don't
know
you know that?
that?
And I was like, oh, okay. So I guess we're okay. But then they also said, but don't you realize that that's what all states do? That's what all governments do 100 years ago. If you're going back, you know, that's what the British Empire did. That's what the Austro-Hungarian Empire did. That's what all the big empires did, was they made money selling alcohol. You know, that's what the United States did. And so I was like, oh, okay. Well, maybe I should rethink some of this. And that was kind of the lead into this project that, you know, that I've been working on for the last 5 years. Should be coming out in May of this year. It's essentially a global history of alcohol and prohibition and prohibitionism and temperance and so on. And so one of the things I found in this research was that if you look, you know, the way that we understand prohibitionism in the United States is that it was like a conservative reactionary movement. It was evangelical Bible thumpers telling you what thou shall and shan't drink, right? He's legislating morality. And, you know, and so that was really interesting to me, because if you go to Russia, they had prohibition too, right? But there were no evangelical Bible thumpers in Russia. And in fact, there were 11 different countries around the globe that had prohibition. None of them had evangelical Bible thumpers and tended to be very progressive, you know. And so the people who were advocating for prohibition and temperance were, you know, people like Mahatma Gandhi or Leo Tolstoy or Vladimir Lenin. None of these are evangelicals, and none of them are conservative. And so my idea was, okay, instead of taking what we think we know about prohibition in the United States and then kind of mapping it on the rest of the world, why don't we go see what was going on in the rest of the world and then bring it back to the United States and see if there's
comparative analysis of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what I did. And so that was the proposal. And so I've got chapters, you know, it goes like empire by empire. So it starts back in Russia because of the reasons I already told you, right? the history that I have there. And so it starts with Russia and looks at Russia. Then it goes to Sweden. It goes to Belgium, the Belgian Congo, if we're talking empires and so on. Austro-Hungarian Empire, German Empire, and it's got like five chapters on the British Empire dealing with Ireland, the British Empire dealing with South Africa, dealing with India, dealing with Australia, doing, you know, all this sort of stuff. And what you find when you do that is that temperance and prohibitionism wasn't a, you know, conservative reactionary movement. It had very little to do with morality. It was all an economic movement. It was like community protection. It was this European distilled import that's coming in, and we need to protect our community against that. And that's what it was in all these different places. Hmm. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And that was going to be the end of it, right? And I was going to have like one chapter on the United States. This is what we find, and this is why it's important, yada yada. And then I met with some of my colleagues, and we're kind of hashing these things over, and she says, okay, well, if prohibitionism really was about indigenous populations kind of protecting themselves against sort of this European cultural imposition, what about the United States? What about Native Americans? What about African Americans? And I was like, oh, damn, you're right. You're absolutely right. And that moment, that revelation that, oh, geez, now I got to look at the United States and American history, that added like 2 whole years to this project.
Wow.
And so, as it turns out, it's the exact same thing that happened. The first prohibitionists in the United States were Native Americans and African Americans. And these are the things that we just don't ever see because we're not looking for it. We're used to the standard trope that it's, you know, conservative, white, evangelical Protestants. You know, we don't look for, you know, Native American prohibition or African American prohibition. I've got an article that's coming out in Politico next weekend, essentially just on that, looking at how, you know, Frederick Douglass was a prohibitionist and Abraham Lincoln was a prohibitionist. These are the people you don't think of when that, you know, you throw that word out there. But one of the things that try to bring this full circle, bring this back to typewriters, is that, you know, as I was going through and you know, writing up this huge thing, it's going to be like 700 odd pages. It's a massive, you know, investment of time and energy. You know, I'm a visual person. I'm a visual learner. So I like to put pictures in there that have something to do with typewriters, right? So like the Russian section, I've got a picture, you know, I went out and secured the rights to this famous picture of Leo Tolstoy and his Remington, you know, and his daughter is transcribing his correspondence on a Remington. And anytime I could find a typewriter, I'd slide one in kind of sideways. and so one of the guys that I'm really fascinated with, and probably my next book project is going to be a biography of this guy. His name is Pussyfoot Johnson. He was a globe-trotting American prohibitionist, and one of his last pictures that, you know, was taken of him is during the Great Depression, and he's kind of hunched over. He's this old guy, kind of broken by the depression in life at that point. But he's got this old Remington 12 that he's just working on, and he's writing his autobiography on it. And so I had to put that in, and that kind of drew in me sort of this interest in finding his typewriter, right? You know, figuring out what he was working on. And this has been, you know, a long time ago that I stumbled across this stuff. So I have to get a Remington 12 just like that, so I can be like Pussyfoot and put it in my office just like he had, you know, with all the wooden accoutrements and the wooden desk and the wooden file cabinets and everything that was there. So that's just kind of how it all kind of comes together. And so that book will be out, like I said, in late spring, early summer of 2021. And if you look, if you read through, I've folded in quite a few typewriters and typewriter references throughout the entire thing.
Cool. Do you find when you're doing your research that sometimes you get distracted because there's somehow a typewriter popped into your research?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, this Pussyfoot guy, I've transcribed his autobiography, which was entirely typewritten. And now I have a picture of him working on it, and I've held it in my hands and I've typed it all out word for word into, word processor. But also, I've gone through all of his correspondences, all of his stuff, and it just keeps popping up, that he would be, he would talk about how he was working, and he was a journalist as well. So he had kind of this flair for words and wordsmithery, and he had this stock phrase that I try to use all the time. He said, I would be rattling my typewriter. I'd be at work one day rattling my typewriter, and that was his thing that he was trying to get work done. But that was like the stock phrase that he always used was just rattling the typewriter. And so I try to use that as much as I can in my own stuff.
It starts to become part of your own vernacular.
Yeah, exactly. And I found one of these things. He was actually on a trip. He was supposed to go he was in London at one point. He was going to New Zealand. They were having a prohibition vote, right? Sort of a referendum on prohibition that he was going to go and try to stump for it down there. And they didn't get outside of the English Channel, and they ran into a fog bank, and so on the steamship that he was taking, and they got rammed by another shipping liner, right? And reading his firsthand account of it, everybody was freaking out, like it was like Titanic, that this ship was going to go down. It ultimately it hobbled back into port, but his recollection of it was that the bow of the ship smashed into his stateroom. And the quote that he said was, it smashed into my stateroom quite as if it had something personally against me. And he was so upset because it crushed his typewriter.
Oh.
That was the thing that he was so upset about. And I keep thinking about that because, we work around typewriters. We're around them all the time. They're pretty, rigid things. But how do you crush a typewriter? What does that look like, to have a ship smash into your room and destroy your typewriter for you? Right? So.
Wow.
I guess that would be the equivalent today of, oh my goodness, I dropped my iPhone.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, to be sure. But those are the types of distractions that I get into. It's like, okay, well, what the heck was that all about? How does that?
That's a good distraction. That's amazing. I love that.
How did he get his name? It's kind of a very unique nickname.
He was, his name was William Eugene Johnson, and before he started his life as a kind of a temperance man, he moved from upstate New York to the Midwest. He was actually at the University of Nebraska for a couple of years, went back to DC, was doing all this work, and he was hired as the special envoy. This is during the Roosevelt administration, Teddy Roosevelt administration. He was sent to the Indian Territory of what is now Oklahoma to essentially be the prohibition enforcement agent in this lawless territory. And so he, this East Coast guy kind of comes in, is going to clean up the territory. And so he's, coming in and smashing up saloons, smashing up gambling dens and so on. And he used to do it kind of front and center. He'd just walk into a place and, put people under arrest. You're gambling illegally in this den, and you're selling liquor, which you shouldn't, because it's against the law. The bad guys started getting after him, right? They put bounties on his head. And so he switched from sort of these daytime raids to kind of very stealthy nighttime raids. And one of the journalists suggested that, that he was so stealthy in his raids of these liquor places, they started calling him Pussyfoot, that he would sneak up on things very clandestinely. And then it just kind of stuck after that and became his moniker. It's on his, I visited his tomb. It's on his, it just says Pussyfoot Johnson on his tomb.
Oh, wow.
But actually, if you go back, that's, you've probably heard the term Pussyfoot, right?
Oh, yeah.
To Pussyfoot around. It's from him. That's how we got that phrase.
Oh, wow. Nobody would have ever connected that. Mm-mm. I mean, you would have thought somehow they got it before. But, yeah, isn't it interesting? And what years are these? Is this the 1920s?
this is, yeah, so he was chief prohibition agent probably about 1909, and then, you know, kind of started this globe-trotting prohibitionism. He's a big name. Pussyfooting is a big thing in Great Britain because he was in Britain for a long time as part of this kind of global prohibitionism. And the British were especially, you know, not only did they not want to give up their alcohol, but they certainly didn't want an American coming in and telling them what to do. Right.
Exactly.
So he was loath. There was actually a riot. There started a riot through the streets of London when he was there, which, again, this is something I describe in the book quite a bit. But, you know, so pussyfooting, a lot of the references that you find, you know, there were songs that were written about, you know, pussyfooting. There's a pussyfooting, you know, jazz, jazz wow. song. And I think there's even like a Disney character, like one of the, I think maybe in, not maybe Pinocchio or one of the early Disney films has like a little cat and the cat's name is Pussyfoot.
Oh, yes,
it's,
yes.
It all kind of wraps around in that way.
Isn't it just so odd how things can link to one thing and then years later it's part of what we say? It's so unique.
Oh, yeah.
It's yeah. Well, it's kind of, to take it back to typewriters, it's kind of like you think about, I meet these young people at my office that come in to intern and whatnot, and they're like, wow, that looks like my phone, you know, talking about the keyboard. And I'm like, well, mm-hmm. there you go.
That's where it came from.
Yep. Same thing, different place, right? Different time.
Yeah, I've been taking cues from David and taking up typewriters and slipping them into the office in places.
Yeah.
We've got two offices that are side by side.
I started with two at the office in my own office, and then my boss came up and said, hey, we have all this extra space. You ought to adorn some of the areas with it. And I went from two to, like, I think there's almost 45 yeah. up in there.
Yeah, we just recently inventoried.
we have people that come in and but you know, like you said with your students, they make unique conversation pieces. We were even having a mediation there one day between two parties who did not like each other. But the unique thing about it is when they broke for just a mini conference in between the two rooms, the mediator with the two attorneys, they stopped for a quick second. I just happened to be in the perfect place at the reception desk, and they stopped for a quick second and started admiring the typewriters. And I thought, yes.
Exactly.
if they hadn't have been in the middle of that, I would have gone over and said, hey, well, let me tell you a little bit about these right. typewriters. But still, it's so neat to me and you because you know, talk so much about history, about how typewriters, as far back as when they were so usable in their, you know, in their time in the early 1900s up through the 50s, 60s, they're still relevant today. There's this resurgence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The resurgence of typewriters?
Yeah.
Or your thoughts on it.
Or your thoughts on it. Your thoughts on it, right? Yeah, is what I meant.
Oh, you mean like more recently, like the, you know, the people who are online now, you know, wanting to rediscover that, or
yeah,
or
yeah. What is your thought on people that are the so many young people are now interested in typewriters, and what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think it's great. You know, just as much enthusiasm as possible, right? Try to keep these things going forward, because obviously, if they die out with one generation, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So you know, the more people, the better. The more, the merrier. I think when it comes to you know, getting people interested into typewriters and to you know, to pursuing this. So it's really encouraging to see sort of the broader typewriter community. Is so diverse. It's not just, you know, it's not just old white guys.
Right, know, exactly.
I think if you, what is it, even in the, you know, the California typewriter movie, I think near the end, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was Ed Herman. Somebody says that most of the typewriter collectors tend to be old white guys, you know, and I think that's changing. And I think that's all to the good, because they speak to so many different, you know, differences based on, you know, age, to be sure, but also, you know, ethnicity and gender and all these different things. It's so, it was really cool, especially, you know, when we did the online Hermans this year, that I think there was like a lull in the conversation somewhere, and somebody started to bring up, you know, sort of the changing landscape of collecting. And it's not just, you know, just old white guys anymore.
Right.
There's a lot more diversity, and that's all to the good. Right?
Yeah, I noticed that. I remember that conversation. Somebody brought it up and said, why are, I think looking at all the faces, one of the people made a comment, why are we all white? And
yeah.
And I think, I think I said something to the effect of we're not. Mm-hmm. Is the whole thing. I mean, maybe on the screen at this very moment we are, but the Austin Typewriter Inc. group, and it's really not a bunch of old white guys. I mean, you get the, I'm becoming a little old white guy. So, yeah,
but, me too. But even here locally, next Sunday, actually, I'm about to gift a little girl. She is Philippine, I think. Her mother's Filipino.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to gift her 10-year-old daughter a typewriter. That's when Everett actually helped me clean up. And so she's 10. There's just in this little circle that Everett and I kind of swim in, you know, in our neighborhoods, there's just a diversity of interest. And I think that's really neat. I mean,
yeah, I love that.
It breaks it up.
Absolutely. I think there's something really strong with having diversity and people using these machines in different ways. It's wonderful.
And that's the thing that I love the most about typewriters, and give me your thoughts on it, is what people do with them. I mean, some people are collectors, some people are writers, some people create art. What is your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the variety of uses, just like anything else. I mean, it's creativity, it's sort of the expansiveness of it. You know, personally, I don't use typewriters so much for writing. I use it for grading. That's fine. But like when it comes to writing books and stuff, I'll stick to my computer. But so there are the variety of uses. But also, I think, you know, just circling back to the sort of the diversity. One of the things I love about the, you know, Austin Typewriter Group, and also the, you know, the Antique Typewriter Collectors page as well, is that it is so global in scope. And
absolutely,
you know, it's this all-inclusive community, and I've met, you know, just looking at the people I have, you know, that are Facebook friends with now, are people from all over the world, you know, and people of all ethnicities, all interest levels, all, you know, and we are able to come together with this one shared interest in typewriters, and we can put away a lot of these differences. And I've had differences, you know, I've had political differences with people on on these communities. But for the most part, it's one of those things that allows us to bridge those types of divides. You know, there are people I know in various communities that my politics and their politics just do not mix. But we can put that aside and we can talk about, you know, this new Underwood that I just got, you know, and we can, you know, kind of marvel together at some of these other different things. So I think it's a great way to, you know, sort of bridge those divides and transcend some of the divisions, whether they're ethnic divisions, whether they're political divisions, whether they're global or local, you know, it's all coming together. And I think that's really great, you know, for our typewriter community.
I agree. And what's really unique when you think about it from, like, you take 100 steps back, is to see the history from the actual invention of the typewriter all the way through the last 130 years or so. The typewriter is still there through all that the world has gone through: wars, famine, depression, great times, good times, bad times, whatever. The typewriter has continued to maintain its integrity of just being a typewriter. It's nothing different other than it's a machine.
It still does what it was intended to do.
Exactly. But what yep. we do with it as people, how we communicate, how we educate, how we enjoy the passion of what we do, is it's about the machine. And I think that in itself is so unique. And even with all the things you talked about just a little while ago through the prohibition and all the things that have gone on in other countries, either abroad or even here in the United States, the typewriter somehow, some way has interwoven into all that. Somewhere in the background, there's that typewriter. Even when you watch, you know, history movies, documentaries, somewhere in the background, there's a typewriter. You don't necessarily always catch it if you're not interested in typewriters, but you see it. It's there.
Oh, I'm catching those all the time.
Right, more and more, right?
When you're interested, you know, sort of seeing those. But you're right. I mean, even the one we started this whole conversation with, this Gerlach typewriter, you know, that was built in the United States, sold in Russia. Just sort of fantasizing about who had this, what was the history of it, you know, and what did it see? I mean, the one we were talking about was manufactured, according to the database, in May of 1914, right? So that's still imperial era. That's, you know, literally a month or two before World War I breaks out. So maybe this typewriter was on a ship heading to Europe when, you know, sort of the guns of war of World War One break out. And so what happens to this typewriter once it gets to Europe? You know, where does it go? All the borders are closed. Is that how it ended up in Norway?
Right, exactly, right.
Who knows what's going on with these? One of my other favorite ones, just a quick one I'll share with you. This one came from a couple years ago. It was an Underwood portable that I can't remember who it was online, kind of brought to my attention because they knew I do Russia stuff. But it was an Underwood portable four bank from, you know, the 1920s. But it was in old Cyrillic Russian, which, you know, sometimes happens. But what was really interesting about it is that it had a dealer tag on it, on the case, that said Kunst und Albers, and it was written also in Chinese. And so what it was Kunst und Albers was this German department store that had a lot of outlets all over the place. But this was in Harbin, China, is where we were able to trace this one. And so this was a, you know, another one of these ones. It was an American-made machine, you know, factory outfitted with old church Russian, you know, so like the pre-orthographic reform. So like, you know, 1917, when the Bolsheviks come in, they changed the entire Russian alphabet. So this is actually a pre-reform alphabet. So, you know, some of the old believers, some of the whites, as they were known, you know, the non-reds, the Russian imperials, would keep to this old type of, you know, typeset and this old font. So American made for Russia, sent to a German store in Harbin, China, and then at some point comes back to the United States and, you know, again, ends up with me, right? So
wow.
to kind of trace the arc of these things. And I've gone so far as, like, with that one, it actually has a sticker on the side of the case with a date that it came, you know, it's a U.S. Customs sticker that suggested that it came back into the United States on September 9th, 1932. And so I actually took this typewriter with me when I was doing archival research for my last book project. I was going down to the National Archives. And so, you know, completely unrelated to the liquor stuff I'm interested in, I lug this typewriter in and I point to this sticker and I said, is there any way that we can trace this stamp, you know, this custom stamp from 1932, because it has a particular identification number. Is there a way that we can tie that to where this came in and who may have owned this typewriter originally? Because that's the thing that really fascinates me. I want to know who was the person who bought this, who was the person who had this originally, right? And they said that it was possible to do that, but those records aren't held in Washington, D.C. Those records would be held at the port of wherever it was that this thing came in. So probably somewhere on the West Coast, you know, one of the ports of entry probably has a ledger that can help me trace those things out. But
road trip,
right?
Yeah, to be sure. But do you find the same thing? Like, do you like obsess about who bought this?
Yep.
Who owned this?
I've got three machines that I've documented clearly who owned them, and some of the people that I bought these machines from. One of the guys is he wrote some books on the Book of Kells in England, and he's got it's a Bijou German machine. It's set up for English and QWERTY, and it's a multi-language keyboard. And so it's got the stamps all over the machine, and it's got the history. Because the lady who gave it, or I bought it from, had documented it, and she said this belonged to, you know, this man who wrote the Book of Kells. He worked for this museum, and, you know, so she gave me the full history of it. She actually typed it out on the machine and everything. So there's something completely fascinating about it. And so I, you know, Googled him, and, you know, he's written, you know, he's doctor so-and-so, and he's written all these books on these things. So, and on that machine, you know, wow. So it's pretty fascinating to me how, I don't know, something tactile about being able to go back and touch the machine that somebody used to do work on. So there's something that there's a direct connection to that person from, you know, 100 years ago and or, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah. So our friend Jody Steele up in Seattle, she had been looking for the Remington, was it the Model 1 portable at some point, Model 2? Anyway, I had one
it's Remington 2.
Yeah, yes. It was a Model 2. And so I had one, and I had been sitting in storage, so I shipped it to her. And I didn't really think anything about the history of it. I just liked the typewriter, but she was more interested, like you, in the history and where it'd been. And it had all these stickers on it. And she discovered that it was on board a Lithuania-type ship that ended up sinking like maybe a month later because it had the stickers and whatnot on there. So she was able to do some research just based on the stickers that were on that particular machine. That, you know, just the history there is just so unique, you know.
Yeah. To be sure. And finding, I think preserving those histories, if you can, I think is just as important as preserving the machines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a couple, this is a couple of years ago. I was coming back. We were doing our Trans-American voyage for Thanksgiving from Philadelphia to Iowa, Iowa back to Philadelphia. And this one, we were coming back from Iowa and outrunning this ice storm that was bearing down on us. So we were driving as quickly as we could.
No.
But we arranged, you know, when you go on those long types of trips, I'm always looking at, you know, Craigslist ads and OfferUp and all those different places along the line to see if there's anything that I could, you know, swing. And this one actually worked out. In Indianapolis, they had I found a Royal P. It was in duotone orange.
Ooh.
And so I was like, okay, you know, so I it was on OfferUp. It was there forever, right? So it was like one of those things for like, it said the ad had been up for like 4 months.
Wow.
And I was like, I will take that if we can figure out a way as we're coming through with the speed of light, you know, going at 75 miles an hour through Indianapolis. If there's a way we can swap, you know, I will happily take that off your hands. And so the seller said, yeah, we can work on that. And, you know, I was giving her like real-time updates as we're driving down I-74. So we met. And the place that she wanted to meet, it was 11 o'clock in the morning, maybe. So nothing nefarious. But she says, probably an easy place to meet is right off the interstate, right by the Indianapolis airport. There's a strip club. And we can meet in that parking lot. And I'm like, okay, fine.
With my kids.
Right? Yep, wife and kids.
I got a van full of kids, and my wife is here. We're going to go to a strip club at 11 in the morning. But I'm glad that I did because, you know, I pulled up, I got this this Royal P, and they took off. They took their money and didn't tell me about, you know, who owned it or anything that was associated with it. And I looked down, and it's in Vogue, right? So I got a Vogue orange Royal P. But the point is, like, cycling back around, who did this? Who bought it? You know, who were you in 1929? You know, what kind of bohemian buys an orange typewriter in 1929, right? Who was this person that has Vogue, right? You know, Vogue orange, that's somebody who's trying to make a statement about something. You know, I don't know who it is or what it was. But again, I'm glad that it kind of ended up in my lap, you know, trying to figure these things out. And one other one, I've got a bajillion stories, but this is one that I found was particularly interesting. But right before COVID, I found this listing for a Triumph typewriter, you know, so portable model number one in Lansdale, which is probably a half hour north of here, northern Philly suburbs. And it was a girl, she was selling it for her grandmother. Like I said, this was right before COVID, right before the lockdown. This is the last thing I did before the lockdown. And I ran up there and got it. And I sat down with the lady, the grandmother who was selling this. And it was a 1929 Triumph portable. And incredibly well maintained, in German, obviously. And the lady I was buying was, you know, she had a kind of a thick German accent, this older lady. She was probably in her 80s or maybe even early 90s. But we sat down and we talked about it. And we, you know, I sat there and we had tea and we talked about it for like an hour of, you know, the history of this particular typewriter. And she told me this whole story that this was her first husband's typewriter. And his name was Wilhelm Müller, and Wilhelm Müller was he was interested in music and arts and so on, and this was in the 1920s, and so he was interested in in the arts and so on in Nuremberg, which is where the Triumph was from, and so they ended up, you know, getting married. And they moved to the Sudetenland. This is 1920s, 1930s Germany. So this is, you know, sort of Nazi era. And so ultimately, you know, they're in the Sudetenland of now Czechoslovakia, and he's a teacher. He's an artist. He's a musician, right? And so kind of a bohemian guy, right? And she's telling me very fondly about the history of this. And so only at the very end of the war, like 1944, you know, when the Nazis are trying to draft everybody and anybody who can hold a gun into their war machine, did they call up and conscript Wilhelm? And that's the last she ever sees of him, right? So he dies probably on the Eastern Front.
Wow.
In some mass grave somewhere. And then after the war is over, she's given, she tells me the story. She's given an 18-hour heads up that she is being deported, as are all the other Germans, out of Czechoslovakia and back to Germany, to Bavaria. And so, they're told that they can only take what they can carry. And so she grabs some clothes and this typewriter.
Oh, that I knew it. I heard it coming.
Yeah, of this memory. And so she takes it and, moves back to Germany, remarries eventually, immigrates to the United States in the 1960s, and brings the typewriter with them. And so, it was fascinating to hear this whole story and to chronicle it and to have it all as part of that, because, while we were sitting there around her very nice, suburban kitchen, and dining room, she was like, my kids, they don't have any interest in this. This is our family. This is our history, and so it was in giving it to me and to selling it and sort of entrusting it to me. It was kind of preserving the history and preserving, her first love, Wilhelm. And she got really raw with the emotions.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Kind of sharing her first love. And this was her connection. This was her only connection to first love.
Can you imagine that the life that she had there before when she was with him, and then she never sees him again? Here's the typewriter. It's there. Yep. It's just It's just something in hand. And then her life comes to this whole other location, and it's almost like two different worlds, but yet the typewriter's still there. And that you,
it's the connection.
You hold that in your, please tell me you have that written down somewhere so that, that story is never lost.
It's, I typed it up and, I typed it up as soon as I got, got it
on that machine.
Like, I have to get this down on that machine.
Oh God.
And it's a great machine.
Man, you need to take pictures and post that. I don't know if I've ever seen that one.
Oh, it's already up there.
Have I seen it? Okay.
I can share it with you online. Yeah, okay. It's up there somewhere. So.
Man, that,
that's awesome.
That is my favorite story right now. That is just I was sitting over here just like watering my eyes, just going, man, I think when you said he's in this mass grave somewhere, you don't even know where he's at.
Right.
Yet a piece of him, that typewriter, that story, her love, their love, still is part of our lives all these years later.
Yeah. And like I said, that's why, for me, I think it's, the machine is cool. And if you can find the story and the history of who bought it and who had it and what they used it for, that's great. But, if you can find like a personal story and those personal connections, that for me is like the tragedy sometimes when you see these machines that get sold at auction or, that are just out there as part of a giant, lot of typewriters. They've come disconnected from their origins, right? There's no history to it, right? So when you buy a typewriter and they say, I found it in the attic when we bought the place, I feel like a sense of loss. Like, there's something more there that I could know, but we never will know, because we don't know who owned this before, right? And we don't know what their story was. If there was a way to preserve that a little bit better, I really wish we could.
And I'm gonna bring this to a close. Talk a little bit about your family. Does your family participate in your typewriter interest, or is this just your interest?
A little bit here and there. I've got three kids. Two of them have their own typewriters. My son Alexander has a Remington. No, he's got an Underwood S, and my daughter has a Smith Corona portable. My wife kind of takes an interest in it, so she can appreciate that I appreciate something, right? And can look at something and go, hey, that's pretty cool. Wow, that's a really interesting machine, right? And then just kind of goes on her way. That all changed a little bit back in November. I went to New Jersey to pick up a typewriter. Actually, it was kind of a lot of typewriters. I don't know, maybe it was like five or six different typewriters I got at that particular case. And one of them was a Corona Special. The flat top version,
mm-hmm. Right?
You know what I'm talking about, with like the red panel in the front and the inlaid silver crown on the top. And I was like, whoa, these are pretty rare. You don't find a whole lot of these Corona specials with the flat, you know, the flat top. And my wife looked at it. She's like, that is one sexy beast. I think that one's mine now. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So this one's yours now. You know, and just like that, we've got another typewriter collector in the family.
That's
I don't know if she's collecting, but that one's Jen's now. So.
Well, I love it.
Well, I know you've got places to go, but I have really enjoyed this last hour that we've shared together. Are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share in this podcast?
No, I just appreciate what you guys do. Holding this community together, I think, is part of it. Building community and you know, the online part kind of takes care of itself. But sort of bolstering community with what you're doing with the podcast, with these type-ins locally, it's wonderful to see. It's something that I think we need more of. But I'm glad to see you're out there on the front lines doing it every day.
Well, thanks. I really I've told Everett this many times. I get more excited when I meet people like you or people that I've met at Herman's.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the people. It really is the people. Like you were saying earlier, the stories are part of it, and then there's the connect. That these typewriters are really, for me, connections back to, you know, the original users and wondering what they were used for. It's wonderful.
Yeah, like,
absolutely.
And you've shared some great stories with us, and I want to invite you to come back again in the future. I'm sure you've got a lot more stories to tell.
Oh, sure. I'll keep collecting the stories. Those are the
exactly.
fun parts, right?
That's great.
It's the people and it's the histories.
All right. Well, folks, we are here with Mark Schrod. He is over in Pennsylvania. And we've shared a wonderful story. I want to thank you again for coming onto the podcast today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
All right. All right. I'm here with Everito and the Garaje Henderson. We're having a great podcast. We'll catch you next time right here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Thank you for listening to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. For more information about our group, please find us online at austintypewriterinc.com, or you can also visit us on Facebook and Instagram. Join us next time for another episode of Austin Typewriter Inc. May your type slugs always be clean.